Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Deshakalachayuktani
Vrittapo Pashyamanisha
Vrittapo Pashyamanisha
Arandi Smarachaschitam
Arandi Smarachaschitam
Govinda Vihitani Me
Govinda Vihitani Me
Deshakalachayuktani Vrittapo Pashyamanisha
Vrittapo Pashyamanisha
Aranti Smaratashchitam
Aranti Smaratashchitam
Govinda Vihitani Me
Govinda Vihitani Me
Deshakalata Yuktani
Deshakalata Yuktani
Vrittapo Pashyamanisha
Vrittapo Pashyamanisha
Aranti Smaratashchitam
Aranti Smaratashchitam
Govinda Vihitani Me
Govinda Vihitani Me
Abhihitani
Abhihitani
Narrated by
Me
Unto me.
Unto me.
Translation. Now I am attracted to those instructions imparted to me by the personality of Godhead, Govinda, because they are impregnated with instructions for relieving the burning heart in all circumstances of time and space. Herein Arjuna refers to the instruction of the Bhagavad Gita, which was imparted to him by the Lord on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. The Lord left behind him the instructions of the Bhagavad Gita, not for the benefit of Arjuna alone, but also for all time and in all lands. The Bhagavad Gita, being spoken by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is the essence of all Vedic wisdom. It is nicely presented by the Lord himself for all who have very little time to go through the vast Vedic literatures like the Upanishads, Puranas, and Vedanta Sutras. It is put within the study of the great historical epic, Mahabharata, which was especially prepared for the less intelligent class, namely the women, the laborers, and those who are worthless descendants of the brahmanas, kshatriyas, and higher sections of the vaishyas. The problem which arose in the heart of Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra was solved by the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. Again, after the departure of the Lord from the vision of earthly people, when Arjuna was face to face with being vanquished in his acquired power and prominence, he wanted again to remember the great teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, just to teach all concerned that the Bhagavad Gita can be consulted in all critical times, not only for solace from all kinds of mental agonies, but also for the way out of great entanglements which may embarrass one in some critical hour. The merciful Lord left behind him the great teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, so that one can take the instructions of the Lord even when he is not visible to material eyesight. Material senses cannot have any estimation of the Supreme Lord, but by his inconceivable power, the Lord can incarnate himself to the sense perception of the conditioned souls in a suitable manner through the agency of matter, which is also another form of the Lord's manifested energy. Thus, the Bhagavad Gita or any authentic scriptural sound representation of the Lord is also the incarnation of the Lord. There is no difference between the sound representation of the Lord and the Lord himself. One can derive the same benefit from the Bhagavad Gita as Arjuna did in the personal presence of the Lord. Om Yajnachirananthasya Gyananjana Shalabhaya Chamshurvetamina Tasumai Shri Guru Vedama Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Guru Nitvana Sri Advaita Vidaha Sivasani Gaur Bhaktarinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. What is it that usually, in fact always, renders material knowledge obsolete, ineffective, and even false? Desha, kala, space and time, the particular place, and even though the particular place may be the same, time changes, therefore the place changes. In Western so-called civilization, people consider it progress that new scientific theories are always coming out. But those theories are simply replacing previous theories, and the present theories will be replaced in the future. So how is that progress? People think, oh, we're getting closer and closer to the truth by continuing to change our scientific theories. But the Vedas explain to you that you're living in darkness. Om Ajnana Chimanandasya. Your senses are limited. They're imperfect. You're always going to be revising your material knowledge. That's the way of material existence. Your knowledge is spoiled by the illusory energy. Krishna explains the process in Bhagavad Gita. Mogasha, moga karmano, moga jnana vichintasa. Krishna assures you, by contact with the material energy, all your hopes for knowledge will be destroyed. Of course, we have the false confidence that tells us I may interact with the material energy as I like, and I'll be sharp, intelligent, witty, profound, mature, and experienced. Where do we get this false confidence from? That false confidence is also the gift of material nature. Just see, there's a twofold process going on in contact with the material nature. You become bewildered, and while you're being bewildered, you also get false confidence that I'm doing fine. I know so much. I'm knowing more in the future. When we say, Om Ajnana Chimanandasya, we're referring to the darkness of ignorance that the conditioned soul is born into. Sometimes people refer to the original sin in Christian cultures. They talk about that. The original sin brings about ignorance, and ignorance brings more sin. This is the penalty we pay for consorting with Maya. We're already blinded, and then by interacting with the illusory energy, we become more blinded, and therefore we do even more illegal things. Bad karmic things. So the cycle just goes on and on, lifetime after lifetime. We're trapped, like a silkworm becomes trapped in its own cocoon. But we think that's progress. Let us look into the interior. Let us look into the heart and see if there's any progress. Do we see human beings increasing in the fine qualities of life? Do we see human beings increasing in what are considered by the Vedas to be the necessary sublime qualities for a decent civilization. Control the mind, control the senses. Austerity, cleanliness, tolerance, honesty, and having both theoretical and realized knowledge of the science of the Supreme. Do we see that? No, we see more and more that people are becoming barbaric. So much so that no one thinks twice about it anymore. You expect the world to be like that. You're shocked if someone acts like a classic gentleman or lady with modesty, courtesy, restraint, tolerance. You're shocked. Oh, what a nice person. Because you rarely meet them anymore. What's happened is that people accept the lowest common denominator. We're all in this together. We're all in the rat race together. So why feel bad about being a rat? Everyone's a rat. No one's better than another. So just be a rat. Get all you can for yourself and a few friendly rats. Rats are friends to you, and leave it at that. People don't feel bad about not being saintly or even gentlemanly or ladylike. They don't feel bad about it. But does it matter? Do what you gotta do. And even if you act crazy for some time, so what? Everyone goes through their crazy moments. So this is the kind of so-called civilization that we live in today. There is no real progress. Just think about that. Real progress is not in terms of gadgets and the overturning of scientific theories, which will only be overturned in the future. Real progress is within the heart. And when there's genuine progress in the heart, genuine cleansing in the heart, then your vision of the external world changes. In other words, there is a correlation between what is in the core of your being and what kind of external world you see and what kind of external world you make. There's a complete correlation. We don't make the mistake that so-called Western civilization makes by making a split between what is within and what is without. What is without is a manifestation of what is within. If your consciousness is impure, you'll see the world differently than someone whose consciousness is becoming purified. So we don't consider technological progress to be real progress at all. We see the damage being done by human beings to themselves, to their environment, to their fellow human beings, to their societies. And people are so foolish, they think, as long as there's money, that's the main thing. When there's not enough money, they become angry. When they think there is going to be a promise of more money, then they're happy. Yes, this is a progressive society, and the money is flowing. So what we are doing, as servants of Lord Chaitanya, is we're proposing a completely different standard of prosperity and progress. Please understand that. The Shastra is redefining those words, prosperity and progress. Or looked at another way, the Shastra is reminding you of what is the genuine meaning of those words. We were speaking yesterday on the boat cruise, or Sunday on the boat cruise, about one of the gifts of Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement is to increase social capital. Social capital means people's development of their personal self and also their establishing and deepening of relationships with others. Not simply their immediate family or their immediate friends, but community spirit. This is what satisfies the self. Even materialistic analysts are agreeing that it's not the money that makes human beings sort of satisfied, speaking materially. We know that materially nothing satisfies the spirit soul. But even looked at from the relative material point of view, it is admitted by social scientists that it's not the money, it's not the prestige or social fame that satisfies or even seems to almost satisfy people. It's their social capital, how much they are developing their inner self and how much they are networking in community relationships. That's how the human being thrives. So what we are doing in the community of devotees is indeed to increase the social capital in which devotees can feel honored, appreciated, cared for, educated, stimulated, cautioned about going off the rails, congratulated for staying on the rails. This is social capital. So let us open our eyes a bit and understand that a human being needs more than just the immediate family and a few friends. Human beings are communal beings. And if they live in a healthy, thriving community, the human being can then feel healthy and wholesome. Combine two things for the social capital: the personal development and the community development. And then you have a healthy human being from the material, relative point of view. So just see how far so-called human society is today from even a healthy material point of view. That's why I often explain, it's a great compliment to call people today a materialist. To call someone a materialist implies some expertise in dealing with the material energy. But what you see today is that people have no idea what is even materially good. They're thrashing about in the name of progress. Their inner qualities are deteriorating more and more. Their mental stability is becoming more and more degraded. Yet, they feel they're making progress. A new scientific theory has come out. A new iPhone has come out. Soon there'll be something even better than Facebook. This is progress. Feel that you're a part of it. Because of this illusion, which is so overpowering to people, they can't see. Their social capital has been depleted. They have no time for their self, and they have no time for community development. That's why you see the statistics show, and you can tell by talking to people, that they're so lonely. Instead of psychological surveys have been done that show, instead of all the smartphones and social networking websites bringing people together and making them more friendly, it's these things have actually isolated people more and more. Because you can't really establish friendships simply by the basis of those technological adaptations. Those technological adaptations give a false sense of intimacy. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Gives you a false sense of togetherness, when actually you're just locked into your computer screen. That's it. Or your smartphone screen. Or your tablet screen. But you think you are connecting at a deep level, but you're not. So the result is that people are becoming more and more lonely in spite of such rapid communication. The technology is destroying them in that it isolates them and gives them a false sense of connectivity. And then people wonder, where are the wholesome relationships we had of yesteryear? Where did the love go? Where's the warm feeling between human beings? We're communicating like never before in terms of speed. But the intimacy is what people want. The depth of human exchanges. That's what they want. That is social capital, we're explaining Sunday. So what Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement offers is a wealth of social capital. Simply to care for the body and mind, which has a place, of course, will not satisfy the human being. Superior to mental and physical care is the spiritual care. So while taking care of the body and mind, that should not be neglected, the main focus should be on the spiritual community. One prominent environmental activist, written many books, one of the first ones, in fact, the first one to present to the non-specialist world the danger of global warming and climate change some 25 years ago. He, along with other environmentalists, have been urging that human beings get back to small communities, small towns, develop local means of exchanging valuable things, help out one another. Don't be afraid to live in the country surrounded by a few others. So he was theorizing that the problem with living simply in non-urban areas has always been that people get bored. Just being out in the countryside or being where there's not throngs of people, and there's not shopping malls and cinemas and clubs and restaurants. Traditionally, people get bored when they see all the action that's going on in the city. And realize, here I am stuck out in the country with my veggies and my just like, for example, in India, everyone knows, in India there's so much sentiment about the village life. In fact, some people are making a lot of money by offering you pay to spend a weekend in a village. You can, you know, see the cows milk, and you can feel like you're part of village life while living in very luxurious accommodations in the village. And then on Sunday evening, you can go back to Mumbai and Delhi, and that way your sentiments about village life have been reinvigorated. So people like to have sentiment about living in the country, rural life, but actually, the social scientists point out when they go to the country, to rural areas outside the city, they don't know what to do with themselves. They become afraid of their own mind. They are addicted to being distracted. The so-called mass weapons of distraction have taken their effect. If you're not being distracted, you don't feel right, okay? What's happening? Nothing's distracting me. I have a quiet moment. Oh no, I don't want to think about myself. Anything but that. Distract me, please. Who can I call? Ah, get on Facebook. Find something. Get on the internet. I must be distracted. It's like a demand of the mind. It's screaming out, distract me, distract me. So, what has material expertise come up with for an answer to why people can't live simply? They'll be feeling all alone and bored by living simply. What is the answer? Supposedly, it'll be the internet that saves them, because they can live alone in the countryside but connect to the whole world through the internet. So that's being proposed as a solution to get people back living simply in rural areas. They can, through the internet, they'll feel like they're part of the whole world, and therefore they won't feel bored anymore in the countryside. That's the best they can come up with. Meanwhile, as we said, the other statistics show that the internet doesn't produce any real sense of community, intimacy, personal connection. People are more lonely than ever. So you have millions upon millions of people participating in the social networking who think that they are actually connecting to people. And then they wonder why they're so empty inside, because that connection is just imaginary. Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement provides real social capital. Chanting together. I was watching the devotees this morning, chanting and dancing together. That's social capital. Sitting together, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, taking prasad together, engaging in devotional service together, discussing realizations about serving Krishna. That is increasing the social capital. That is genuine community spirit, as everyone focuses on the pleasure of Sri Sri Radha Balakam. There can be no genuine social capital without the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the center. So this is timeless knowledge, which is not affected by desha, kala, space, and time. Arjuna is revealing the solution to his predicament. His heart is burning. Pritta upashyamani. What is going to extinguish that burning in the heart? You can remember times when you felt your heart was burning, your mind was on fire. Oh, material existence. It's not treating you the way you want it to treat you. What is the solution to put out that affliction, the flames burning your heart and mind, the agony that results from trying to be the enjoyer? And then you may say, if I stop trying to be the enjoyer, that'll also be agony. What to do? I'm damned if I do, damned if I don't. So, if I take up the process of bhakti, what will extinguish this burning in the heart and mind from my trying to be the enjoyer or stopping to be the enjoyer? Both ways, I'm burning. What to do? Haranti smaratas chittam. The solution is attraction to the Supreme Personality of Pleasure. Remembering the Supreme Personality of Pleasure. Arjuna is demonstrating the practical therapy, just so we will know what to do. Afflictions are a part of this world. We hear in the purport that Arjuna had a two-pronged experience by having his consciousness attracted to the instructions imparted to him by Govinda. Number one, he received solace from agony. And number two, he actually received the method for getting out of excruciating entanglements. So there's feeling there, and there's also practical technique. This is Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita will soothe your heart, but it doesn't stop there. We'd all like a soothed heart in moments of crisis. But Bhagavad Gita goes further than that. It gives you the ladder to get out of the burning house. both things. This is so unique. The depths of genuine feeling are there in Bhagavad Gita, and it can deal with the depths of your feelings. At the same time, you are taught techniques for actually how to escape your complicated situation. So how can you do better than that? Bhagavad Gita has heart and head. In the purport, Srila Prabhupada explains that you'll get the same effect that Arjuna had with Krishna on his chariot as you'll get by hearing Bhagavad Gita. Just think about that. Are we going to put in some time to experience this? Isn't this a worthy goal in life? To experience the presence of Krishna by hearing Bhagavad Gita to the same extent that Arjuna has that presence of Krishna with Krishna on his chariot. Is this an exaggeration? What do you think? Such a statement should incite your scientific curiosity. Srila Prabhupada says here, one can derive the same benefit from the Bhagavad Gita as Arjuna did in the personal presence of the Lord. What do you think? Is this just an exaggerated, inflated statement? No, you should take this as great motivation to make real progress. Somehow, in this lifetime, I'm going to experience that. And with all the social capital that Lord Chaitanya is providing in his Sankirtan mission, you can indeed gradually make progress to this point. Real progress. Not that people are depraved, degraded, and crazy within while being surrounded by all sorts of technological innovations that change every year, surrounded by scientific theories that change every year. If you really want to have your head spin, just try keeping track of all the latest scientific theories as they go in and out of popularity or acceptance. But this is presented as progress. Sometimes our devotees, they try to understand what is the latest cosmological theory, for example. What's the latest speculation? New speculations come into being and go out of being so quickly. It's just because there's a vacuum, you see. There is no substantial knowledge. Therefore, that empty space has to be filled with so much speculation. Otherwise, you might start to think the truth that no one really knows what they're talking about. So better fill the air, fill the empty space with speculation. Then you'll think, oh, there's something happening. They're speculating. They're getting closer to the truth. One foremost cosmologist was very honest about the state of cosmology, astrophysics, scientific understanding of the universe and its origin and its fate. He's very honest. He just said, look, I tell you the truth. There's three things you never chase after. A bus, a woman, or a cosmological theory. Because there's always another one coming. So you hear it straight from the horse's mouth there. The effect of all that speculation upon us is we think they're making progress, as I explained. But we have a course, a path for real progress chalked out. When are we going to appreciate that hearing Bhagavad Gita is the same as having Krishna on our chariot as Arjuna did? When will that day be ours? When will we chant Hare Krishna knowing 100% Krishna is dancing on my tongue, I'm associating directly with Krishna through sound? When will I hear Srimad Bhagavatam like that? When will I see the deities as non-different from the Supreme Personality of Godhead? These are what we want to strive. These are goals that we want to strive for. This is worth our whole life. This is real progress. When will I be able to associate properly with devotees, appreciating their glories? When will I stop maximizing whatever faults they may appear to have? When will I see how each devotee, in some way, is trying to contribute to Krishna's service? When will I be able to dance and chant in the association of devotees, just like the associates of Lord Chaitanya dance with one another? These are our career goals. This is real progress. By keeping those goals in mind, we don't become overwhelmed by small-time stuff, you know? Oh, what about this? Oh, what about that? This Prabhu looked at me in the wrong way. This Prabhu didn't use soft language in talking to me. Oh. The whole world's coming to an end. If you keep the real goals in life in mind, you'll be able to handle the small stuff. But when you lose track of the real goals, the small stuff overwhelms you. You become distracted by so many petty discrepancies that you see everywhere. It's always good to remember what are the real goals, what is real progress. We read that the merciful Lord left behind him the great teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, so that one can take the instructions of the Lord even when he is not visible to material eyesight. This is how we should read Bhagavad Gita. We have at our fingertips ready access to the personal presence of Krishna, ready access to the greatest solace for the heart and the greatest technology for getting out of critical situations. This is the confidence that a bhakti yogi has. I've got everything I need. Now I simply have to apply it. I need the social capital of the community to help me apply the great gifts that I already have. So the community of bhakti yogis inspires one another to plunder the wealth that's already made available to us. Here's the money. Spend it. Isn't that glorious? Here's the treasure chest. It's wide open. Take it all. That's what the community of devotees is meant for. Spend the wealth of bhakti. Real progress. Gradually, as we become purified, our mind becomes more and more attracted to Krishna. It's natural. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of pleasure. You want pleasure. What gets in the way is our concoctions. We think we know what pleasure is. We think we know what love is. And therefore we feel this separation, this distance between ourselves and Krishna. But as we engage in devotional service, those concoctions start to corrode. And then our mind can more and more spontaneously be attracted to Krishna. It's natural for the spirit soul to be attracted to the Supreme Soul. I was speaking yesterday to a nice woman who wanted to do good for the world, and she felt that by helping with persons' psychic problems, said she could see complexities that people are carrying from previous lives. She could help them to overcome those complexities. So I said, look, on the material platform, yes, it's true, some persons can see the complexities that persons are carrying around from birth after birth. But what is the actual solution? You may stop the present complexities that they're having, but then material life means more and more complexities come upon you.
you cure someone of the shock from the past, but then more shocks come in the future, because that's the way material existence is. Shock after shock, trauma after trauma, complication after complication. So you're crediting yourself for easing their complexities they're carrying from the past, but what are you going to do about the present and the future? How are you going to stop the shocks? How are you going to stop the complexities? So she said, yeah, that's right. She said, yes, it would be a great breakthrough. First of all, if I could heal all their complexities from the past, which I can't do. I think I can heal some of them. I've had some success. But then I know, in the present, they're implicating themselves in more shocks and complications. And in the future, there'll be so many more. I can't do anything about that. I said, that's right. So, I encouraged her to seriously read Bhagavad Gita and understand how there is solace in Bhagavad Gita. Solace from all kinds of mental agonies, and also technique for getting out of the greatest entanglements, so that you don't have to just go from shock to shock, trauma to trauma, disappointment to disappointment, illusion to illusion, lust to lust, which leads to frustration, which leads to anger. Doesn't have to be like that. Do we have the honesty to admit about our burning heart? A burning heart means you're longing, you're desiring, and those desires aren't fulfilled. And then the burning heart also means that even the rare times when you get what you want, you're not satisfied, your heart is still burning. Oh, what pain. So we recognize what are the flames engulfing our heart. How there is no material solution. So then you ask, why does it look like there's a material solution for my heart? I desire, so shouldn't my desires be fulfilled? What's wrong with thinking like that? It's natural. But we are in an unnatural situation in life. We've forgotten Krishna. So I explained to this nice lady that, all right, you want to help people tune into what is the self. First of all, you yourself have to understand what the self is. But your job doesn't finish there, because the self can only be understood in relation to the Supreme Self, the Om Purnam, the complete whole. So unless you understand both things, the self and the Supreme Self, you're not going to really be able to help anyone. What to speak of helping yourself? I said, oh, that's interesting. I said, do you exist alone in separation from everything? How can you say that you understand yourself thoroughly if you don't know what you're part of? This overall scheme, and that overall scheme happens to be a supreme personality of pleasure. And here you are, a tiny little entity trying to squeeze out some pleasure from the material world, ignoring that Om Purnam, who is not just an abstract theological concept, but who is the supreme personality of pleasure. Our natural state is to be attracted to that supreme personality of pleasure. This is a real career goal worth spending countless lifetimes to achieve. Let's speak of one lifetime. So let us keep in mind what our goals are. And that way, we don't sweat the small stuff. There will be disagreements, even in the Vaishnava community, disagreements on how Krishna should be served, or but those things are very small compared to the great treasures that we can strive for. How am I seeing the deities? How am I hearing Srimad Bhagavatam? How am I chanting Hare Krishna? How am I relating to the devotees? These are our treasures. This is our social capital. which makes us loaded with real wealth. All right, we'll stop here and ask any questions. Yes? You should know that it's there. We become overwhelmed when we forget it's there. But if you know that that great treasure is just up ahead, and it's progressively achieved, it's not all or nothing. Like right now, I'll experience nothing from Krishna until I get the whole treasure. No, the goal is progressively and gradually achieved. So even in the beginning phases of your spiritual life, you can taste some part of the ultimate goal. What does it mean to have confidence in someone or something? You know that that person can deliver the goods. Social capital means a community that gives that confidence, you will achieve the goal if you strive by right means. And sometimes there may be difficulties, but we're here for you to carry you through those difficulties. Everyone likes it when someone says to you, I'm here for you. Right? That is social capital. You can use common sense and logic to bring them near the Shastric conclusion. The proof is not the common sense arguments or the logic arguments. The proof is the Shastra. So in service to the Shastra, you can use things from your experience, you can use logic, you can use common sense to bring them near to the Shastra. But the actual proof is the Shastra, not the logic and reason and common sense that we may use in statements for encouraging people to take seriously what Krishna says. The actual proof is what Krishna says. Now you may become such a powerful outreach devotee that you can just walk up to someone and say, Sarva Dharma Prichaja Mame Kamcharam. And the person immediately accepts everything. This actually happened. One disciple of Srila Prabhupada, he was distributing books in the early 70s, and he was a very simple devotee, very sincere and simple. So he said, well, my spiritual master wants me to distribute his books, I'll do my best. So he was out on the street and he approached one young university student, and he just held out the Bhagavad Gita to him and said, Sarva Dharma Prichaja Mame Kam Sharanam Vaja. The whole verse. And then he couldn't see the university student anymore. The university student had collapsed on the ground. Stunned. The true story. So then the university student picked himself off the pavement and pulled out the book and ran ran 2 kilometers back to his student hostel to read the book, to read Bhagavad Gita, and then immediately became a devotee and became a great general in Srila Prabhupada's Sankirtan mission. So those people are out there. But you have to be able to deal with all kinds of persons. And that takes time. You have to start somewhere. It's like how to be a good doctor. Don't think that just because you're not the most expert doctor in the beginning that your service isn't appreciated by Lord Chaitanya. Your expertise and compassion increases as you endeavor to please Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Nityananda Prabhu. You're always right for presenting the real medicine. It's just you get better and better at how you're being right. So in the beginning, you may just tell someone immediately, look, you know, you should surrender to Krishna. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of God. You're right. And you have given them some purification by reciting Krishna's name, what Krishna says. But as you become more compassionate, more expert, you say what Krishna says in a way that can increasingly motivate them to accept what Krishna says. You always say what Krishna says. But you learn how to say that, what Krishna says, in a way that that is custom made for their circumstances. You learn how to adjust the packaging for time and space, desha and kala, but you don't drop the message. You learn how to wrap the message in a different way, but the kernel is always there. Krishna says this. Bhagavad Gita says that. Otherwise, you have no standing. So our foundation is what Krishna says. And then as you become a more expert doctor, you learn how to administer that medicine of what Krishna says. But you never stop saying what Krishna says. Maybe if I don't say Krishna, they'll appreciate it more. Maybe if I don't mention Bhagavad Gita, they'll realize that I'm non-sectarian. We're not ashamed of Krishna. Suppose someone asks you, do you have a father? I don't want to say yes because they might think that I think my father is the best. And so I want to appear very broad-minded and very accommodating. So, well, do I have a father? Well, you see, everyone's father is actually my father. No, naturally, out of love for your father, you want to glorify him. Yes, I have a father. He can really cook. Come to my house, you can taste when he cooks. You want to glorify your father. You don't feel ashamed. Ooh, you asked about my father. Now, if I tell you the truth about my father, you might think that I'm being puffed up. So therefore, I won't say anything about my father. But as you become older, you become more expert in how to present the glories of the Supreme Personality of God. You have to start somewhere. And you're always right. Even if you just say, look, you should read Bhagavad Gita, you're right. But as you become more expert, based on compassion, you're able to come up with interesting ways to get people to read Bhagavad Gita. So we're not ashamed of Krishna, we're not ashamed of Bhagavad Gita. The doctor has to give the medicine. He may come up with different methods for how to administer the medicine. But still, the medicine has to be there. So go on learning Bhagavad Gita. Okay? Anything else? basically, I was speaking about the relative value of material knowledge in general. It's inferior. It's based on imperfect sense perception. It's based on fallible creatures. So, to that extent, it has value. You mentioned global warming and climate change. Well, there are many persons who think that it's all a fabricated crisis. And even those who are absorbed in the science of climate change and global warming, they admit we can't predict exactly how bad it's going to be and when. We just know something is coming. We can't say exactly. We can't be for sure how much we can avoid and how much is unavoidable. We know something is coming. It's already hit. But we can't say precisely what the outcome will be. So the question is, now, because the naysayers against climate change and global warming, they're shrinking very quickly as the weather gets weirder and weirder. So the question then is, do we tell people how bad it is? Because if we tell them how bad it is, they won't do anything to avert further disaster. Or do we just tell them it's not so bad, if you act now, there's hope? So there's an argument within the environmental movement. How do you approach things? How do you approach giving people the information? You don't want to sound like a doomsayer, even though scientifically they know it looks gloomy. But that doesn't motivate people. You just tell them it's too late. Although that is more and more accepted as the current scientific party line. It's too late to avoid a lot of the effects of global warming. All you can do is mitigate the gloom. One of Australia's top personalities in that field. He's at the Australian National University, and he's head of the most prominent think tank in Australia. And he said like that, look, there's no controversy anymore about the gloomy effects of climate change. But how to tell the people that in a way that they don't become completely discouraged? Because even though the mess is here and it will increase, there's still a chance to minimize the mess. But you can't avoid the mess, but you can still do something to reduce the effects of the mess, even though it's going to be a mess. So there's a whole communications battle within climatologists and climate scientists, so forth. How much do you tell the people? Can you really express what is already going to be what's already happening? Or should we just give them a rosy picture? You can make a difference. You can change the the impending gloom. You can do it. So therefore, they're involving psychologists, of course, for advice. How do you deal with the human mind? You know, this is not simply a scientific problem. This is a human behavioral problem. But you see, that kind of knowledge, regardless of how faulty or not it is not essential knowledge. Essential knowledge is the knowledge of the soul and the supreme soul. So if you just keep those two things in perspective, as Lord Kapiladeva explains to his mother Devahuti, there's paravidya, there is superior knowledge, and there's aparavidya, inferior knowledge. So you don't want your life dominated by inferior knowledge, regardless of whatever temporary value it has. You want your life dominated by paravidya.